Hello, everyone, and welcome to Music, Facts, and Figures, a podcast by Mark Indecito. I'm your host, Mark Indecito, and thank you for tuning in today. This podcast, should I say, not today because it's not live, but thank you for tuning in. It's been a couple of weeks since my last podcast. It's been a busy few weeks. Just time got away from me, and I apologize, but here I am. So I originally said I was going to do a three-part series on the Beatles album Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. It's going to be a four-part series. So last time I did was part one, which was about the album itself, told by the band themselves. Today's going to be part two, about the album cover, told by the band themselves. Next time, I'm going to do part three, which is going to be an excerpt from the book Paul McCartney, Many Years From Now, published in 1997 by Barry Miles. And I'm going to talk more in-depth of the song, A Day in the Life, which was a closing track on the album, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Part four is going to be another article I'm going to read about Brian Wilson and the Beach Boys, talking about his influence on Sgt. Pepper's and the influence he had. So basically, I'm sure you remember the story. So when the Beatles released Rubber Soul in 1965, Brian Wilson, the Beach Boys, was obsessed with the album Rubber Soul and did an album called Pet Sounds, the Beach Boys. They did Pet Sounds in 1966, the next year. And he had another mission going on in his head. He was going to do a project called Smile. Beach Boys, or Brian Wilson mainly, but it was a Beach Boys album, but it was Brian Wilson's idea. But anyway, other things happened between 1966 and 67 that prevented him from doing that. And I'm going to read an article about that, because basically the Beatles were influenced by Pet Sounds to do Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. And, there's an article about Brian Wilson and the influence that it had on him, and that he was going to do this whole thing called Smile, and it was put off because of certain things that the Beatles did, other groups did, basically, and that's about it, pretty much. So, that's part four. So, like the last part, this is not going to be on YouTube. So, in fact, the next couple parts for this Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band saga is going to be not going to be on YouTube, just audio. So you find it on apps such as iHeartRadio, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Apple Podcasts. So let's get started. So this is the album. This is about the album cover, which is just as artistic as the album itself. Kind of funny when you pick up the album cover. When I first saw the album cover, I didn't know what to think of it. I'm like, this is pretty cool, but I was a little confused. I'm like, what's all these people doing on it? You know, you got like celebrities like Marilyn Monroe, Charlie Chaplin, Bob Dylan, you know, went on there. Other various celebrities, Ron Hardy were on there. A lot of different celebrities. It was like a class picture, if you will, of like, there's the Beatles themselves in front, and you had like different rows of people behind them. It was kind of cool. It was different. That was really artistic, if you will. So anyway, let's get started. Part two of the Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band in my History of Music series. We're in 1967, and we're talking about the album again for the 100th time. Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band by the Beatles. This is the album cover. So, first off, let me say my sources. I'll cite my source here. I'm using the book The Beatles Anthology, which was published in 2000. And it was basically what it is. It's a book about the Beatles quotes. You know, all the Beatles quoted about their albums, tours, songs, other things in there throughout their career. So it's basically a quote. So I'm going to name the Beatle who's in a quote, then read their comment. So that's the plan. And first off, I'm going to say cheers. Kind of a Mia Brew here. Samuel Adams, Oktoberfest. I love Sam Adams. I love the Boston Lager, Cherry Wheat. I like their Oktoberfest, and I like their Winterfest. So, yay for Sam Adams, man. They're awesome. Cheers again. Refreshing. All right, here we go. Road manager Neil Aspinall. Brian was in America with his business partner, Nat Weiss. Being a bit nervous, as you sometimes are before flying, he left a note with Nat about the cover for the new album. George Harrison. Brian had a premonition that his plane was going to crash, so he sent a letter saying, brown paper bags for Sgt. Pepper. Paul McCartney. This album was a big production, and we wanted the album sleeve to be really interesting. Everyone agreed. When we were kids, we'd take half an hour bus ride to Lewis's department store to buy an album, and then we come back on the bus, take it out in the brown paper bag, and read it cover to cover. They were the full-size albums. Then, not like CDs. You read them, and you study them. I like the idea of reaching out to the record buyer because of our memories of spending our own hard-earned cash and really loving anyone who gave us value for money. So for the cover, we wouldn't just have our Beatle jackets on, or we wouldn't just be suave guys in turtlenecks looking like we did on Rubber Soul. It would now be much more pantomime, whatever the word is. Much more Mr. Bojangles. For our outfits, we went to Berman's, the theoretical customers, and ordered up the wildest things based on old military tunics. That's where they sent you if you were making a film. Go down to Berman's and get your soldier suits. They had books there, and that showed you what was available. Did we want Edwardian or Creeman? We just chose oddball things from everywhere and put them together. We all chose our own colors and our own materials. You can have that. He's having it. You can't have that. He's having it. We went for bright psychedelic colors, a bit like the fluorescent socks you use to get in the 50s. Became very pink, very turquoise, or very yellow. In the back of our minds, I think the plan was to have garish uniforms, which would actually go against the idea of uniform. At the time, everyone was into that. I was Lord Kitchener's valet. Things kids in bands wearing soldiers' outfits and putting flowers in the barrels of rifles. John Lennon. Pepper was just an evolvement of the Beatle boots and all that. It was just another psychedelic image. Beatle haircuts and boots were just as big as flowered pants in their time. I never felt that when Pepper came out, Hey Asprey was a direct result. It always seemed to me that they were all happening at once. Kids were already wearing army jackets on the King's Road, and all we did was make them famous. Paul McCartney. To help us get into the character of Sgt. Pepper's band, we started to think about who our heroes might be. Well then, who would this band like on the cover? Who would my character admire? We wrote a list. It could be as diverse as we wanted. Marlon Brando, James Dean, Albert Einstein, or whoever. So we started choosing. Dixon Dean, an old Everton football hero I'd heard my dad talk about. I didn't really know him. Groucho Marx, and so on. It got to be anyone we liked. Road manager Neil Aspinall. I remember being in the studio and everybody was asking, who do you want in the band? always crazy suggestions were coming out. John was talking about Albert Stubbins, and nobody quite knew who he was. He was a Liverpool center forward. Ringo Starr. Sgt. Pepper was a special album, so when the time came for the sleeve, we wanted to dress up and we wanted to be these people, all the Peppers. It was flower power coming into its fullest. It was love and peace. It was a fabulous period for me and the world. Paul McCartney. We got artistic people involved. I was very good friends with Robert Fraser, the London art dealer, a guy with one of the greatest visual eyes that I've ever met. It was a great thrill being a friend of his at the time, and I took the whole album cover idea to him. He represented the artist Peter Blake, and he was very good friends with the photographer Michael Cooper. Robert said, "Let Michael take some pictures. We'll get Peter to do a background, and then we'll all collage it all together." I went down to Peter's house and gave him a little drawing of mine as a starting point. The cover was going to be a picture of a presentation somewhere up north. The Beatles being given the keys to the city by the mayor beside a floral clock, like the one they have in the municipal park. And then inside the cover, we were going to be sitting there with pictures of our favorite icons around us. That was the original plan. And then Peter collaged it into one big idea. It all came together and we had the photo session. In the evening, we had all the plants delivered by a florist. People think that they're pot plants, marijuana plants, but they're not. It was all straight. Row manager Neil Aspinall. The sleeve was the result of conversations with Peter Blake. They had a list of people they wanted it standing in the background. So Mal and I went to all the different libraries to get prints of them, which Peter Blake blew up and tinted. He used them to make the collage along with the plants and everything else you see on the cover. Paul McCartney. The Fool were part of our crowd. They were a group of artists who later painted the Baker Street shop and used to make clothes for us. They had wanted to do a big psychedelic painting for the gatefold, and the Beatles loved the idea, but Robert Fraser hated it. He said, "It's not good art." And I said, "Well, I don't care about you, mate. You may not like it, but it's our bloody cover." We stuck out, so the Fool did the painting. Robert kept saying, "No, it's just not a good painting." He did have a great eye for it, and I agree with him now, but it would have been okay for the time. Instead, Robert told us we had to have one of the big forehead photographs from the Michael Cooper session from the gatefold, and he was right. There was a lot of crossover with our friends, with everyone throwing in their two penny worth. When we started dreaming up ideas for the cover, the main problem was the people thought it would be too expensive. They never paid so much to have a cover put together. Normally it was about 70 quid. A good photographer like Angus McBean would come in and take your snap. That would be his fee, £70. Row manager Neil Aspinall. When the cover was finished, Sir Joseph Lockwood had a meeting with Paul. I was there when he brought the album cover in. It had the flowers, the drum, and the four Beatles, and a big blue sky. They wiped out all the people behind because he was frightened they might all sue or not want to be on the cover. Paul McCartney. I said, "Don't worry, Joe. It's going to be great, man." He said, "We have dozens of lawsuits on our hands. It will be absolutely terrible. The legal department is going mad with it." I told them, "Don't worry, just write them all a letter. I bet you they won't mind. So write to them and then come back to me." Road manager Neil Aspinall. Paul refused and said that no way would they lose all their people. In the end, Brian's office wrote to everybody saying, "Sign here if you agree." Everybody did except Leo Gorshi, the Bowery Boys, who wanted $500. He was on the back row, so they just put a bit of blue sky where he had been. Brian thought the sleeve was wonderful. It gave him a bit of a headache having to ask everybody's permission, but he thought the idea was great. George Harrison. There were those who refused me on there, saying, "I'm not a lonely heart," or "I don't want to be on there." Letters had to go out to get permission from everybody, and some people did turn us down. Paul McCartney. At that time, EMI was very much a colonial record company. It still is. They sell records in India and China, so they were all very aware of Indian sensibilities. I remember Sir Joe, a good old mate, actually coming around my house in St. John's Wood saying, "I say, Paul, we really can't do it." "Old chap, you can't have Gandhi," I said. "Why not? We're revering him." "Oh, no, no, it might take the wrong way. It might be taken the wrong way. He's rather sacred in India, you know." So Gandhi had to go. Neil Aspinall, road manager. Gandhi was sitting under the palm tree, so they just put another palm frond there in his place. George Harrison. I still have no idea who chose some of those people. I think Peter Blake put a lot of those more confusing people in there. It was just a broad spectrum of people. The ones I wanted were people I admired. I didn't put anybody on there because I didn't like them, unlike some people. Paul McCartney. John wanted a couple of far-out ones, like Hitler and Jesus, which was John's wanting to be bold and brassy. He was into the risk-taking, and I knew what he was doing. I didn't agree with it, but he was just trying to be far-out, really. Robert Fraser and Michael Cooper were mates for the Rolling Stones, as were we. And they said it would be great to have a reference to the Stones on there. So we slung that in the corner. John Lennon. If you look closely at the album cover, you'll see two people who are flying and two who aren't. That's just a little in joke. Two of them didn't share it with the others. Ringo Starr. Have a look at the cover and come to your own conclusion. There's a lot of red-eyed photos around. Paul McCartney. We wanted the whole of Pepper to be so that you could look at the front cover for years and study all those people and read all the words on the back. And there were little handouts, little badges. We originally wanted to have an envelope stuck inside the sleeve with gifts in. But it became too hard to produce. It was hard enough anyway, and the record company were having to bite the bullet. It was costing a little bit more than their usual 2 pence cardboard cover. John Lennon. Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band is one of the most important steps in our career. It had to be just right. We tried, and I think succeeded in achieving what we set out to do. If we hadn't, then it wouldn't be out now. Producer George Martin. Looking back on Pepper, you can see it was quite an icon. It was the record of that time, and it probably did change the face of recording, but we didn't do it consciously. I think there was a gradual development by the boys as they tried to make life a bit more interesting on record. They felt, we don't have to go up on stage and do this. We can do it just for ourselves and just for the studio. So it became a different kind of art form, like making a film rather than a live performance. That affected their thinking and their writing, and affected the way I put it together too. I think Pepper did represent what the young people were on about, and it seemed to coincide with the revolution in young people's thinking. It was the epitome of the swinging 60s. It linked up with Mary Quant and the miniskirts, and all those things with the freedom of sex, the freedom of soft drugs like marijuana, and so on. John Lennon. It took 9 months. It wasn't 9 months in the studio, but we'd work then stop a bit. Work it out, rest, work. I just like to get in and get out. I get a bit bored. Generally, our other albums took 3 intensive weeks of work. Afterwards, we would slow down for 1 week, and then, of course, the record company was screaming. They screamed at the price of the record cover, etc., etc., and now it's probably pinned all over the walls. Paul McCartney. After the record was finished, I thought it was great. I thought it was a huge advance, and I was very pleased because a month or two earlier, the press and the music papers had been saying, "What are the Beatles up to? Drying up, I suppose." So it was nice to making an album like Pepper and thinking, yeah, drying up, I suppose. That's right. It was lovely to have them on that when it came out. I loved it. I had a party to celebrate. That whole weekend was a bit of a party, as far as I recall. I remember getting telegrams saying, "Long live Sgt. Pepper." People would come around saying, "Great album, man." I certainly got noticed. It was released on a Friday, and on the Sunday, Jimi Hendrix opened with Sgt. Pepper when we saw him at the Savile Theater. That was the single biggest tribute for me. I was a big fan of Jimmy's, and he had only had since Friday to learn it. John was very pleased with the album. It fitted with what we were doing, and he certainly had some great tracks on it. A Day in the Life is a classic. George Harrison. I liked Sgt. Pepper when it was finished. I knew it was different for the public, and I was very happy with the concept of the cover. A Day in the Life had the big orchestra and the big piano chord. And Lucy and the Simon Diamonds, I liked musically, but the rest of it was just ordinary songs. John Lennon. All the differences in Pepper were, in retrospect, it wasn't sitting and thinking, "Oh, we had LSD, so tinkle, tinkle." In those days, reviews weren't very important because we had it made whatever happened. Nowadays, I'm as sensitive as shit, and every review counts. But those days, we were too big to touch. I don't remember the reviews at all. We were so blazed, we never even read the news clippings. I didn't bother with them or read anything about us. It was a bore. Ringo Starr. Sgt. Pepper seemed to capture the mood of that year, and also allowed a lot of people to kick off from there and to really go for it. When that album came out, the public loved it. It was a monster. Everybody loved it, and they all admitted it was a really fine piece of work, which it was. While we were making the album, they thought we were actually there self-indulging, just in the studio, as the Fabs, like in the movies, where people get famous and then end up in the studio writing huge operas that never work out. We, however, were actually in there recording this fine body of work and making, I believe, one of the most popular albums ever. Paul McCartney. Other people were starting to get interested in what we were doing. I always felt that the Stones took our lead and followed. We would do a certain thing like Pepper, and then a year later, they would do Satanic Majesties. There were others. Donovan, for example, who were making some pretty funky little records at the time, but I don't think anyone was getting into the art and craziness of instrumentation as much as we were. The biggest influence, as I had a lot of times, was the Beach Boys' Pet Sounds album, and it was basically the harmonies and I nicked from there. Again, it wasn't really avant-garde, it was just straight music, surf music, but stretched a bit lyrically and lyrically and melodically. You know what I mean. Okay, John Lennon. When you get down to it, it was nothing more than an album called Sgt. Pepper with the tracks stuck together. It was a beautiful idea then, but it doesn't mean a thing now. I actively dislike bits of them which didn't come out right. There are bits of Lucy in the Sky I don't like. Some of the sound in Mr. Kites isn't right. I like Day in the Life, but it's still not half as nice as I thought it was when we were doing it.
I suppose we could have worked harder on it, but I couldn't be honest doing any more. Sergeant Pepper is a nice song. Getting Better is a nice song. And George's Within You Without You is beautiful. But what else is on it musically besides the whole concept of having tracks running into each other? Paul McCartney. The mood of the album was in the spirit of the age because we ourselves were fitting into the mood of the time. The idea wasn't to do anything to cater for that mood. We happened to be in that mood. Anyway, and it wasn't just the general mood of the time that influenced us. I was searching for references that were more on the fringe of things. The actual mood of the time was more likely to be the move or status quo or whatever. Whereas outside of all that, there was this avant-garde mood, which I think was coming into Pepper. There was definitely a movement of people. All I'm saying is we were really trying to cater for the movement. We were just being part of it, as we always had been. I maintain the Beatles weren't the leaders of the generation, but the spokesmen. We were only doing what the kids in the art schools were all doing. It was a wild time, and it feels to me like a time warp. There we were in a magical wizard land with velvet patchwork clothes and burning jaw socks. And here we are now, soberly dressed.
That's all I have. Well, thank you for tuning in. That's all I have for today's podcast. Next time is going to be part 3 of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. It's going to be an article. Well, it's going to be an expert text in the book, the biography of Paul McCartney many years from now, written by Barry Miles, published in 1997. And it's, I Think Life was the last track of the album, and it's very interesting, as you heard in the last podcast, how they recorded it and everything. This article, this part from the book I'm going to read is more detailed on the song itself and the influence and everything else behind it. So that'd be kind of cool to do that next time. Yeah, I think I mentioned it last time, I forgot, but let me mention it now to be safe. Yeah, the album cover for Sgt. Pepper, like I said, is very artistic, just like the album itself was. It was the first Beatles album to have a gatefold, which just means when the album cover has, like, you know, you got the front cover and the back part of the cover, and you open it up like a book, it has an inside picture or something in the inside. And what's interesting, too, it was the first, might have been the first actual album ever, but it was the first pop album, I think. Don't quote me on that, but to contain lyrics to the songs, and it was on the back of the cover. So yeah, that was kind of interesting. But anyway, that's all I have. Thank you for tuning in. If you like my podcast, please follow me. Please listen to it on the following apps: Spotify, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, and Apple Podcasts. I appreciate you tuning in. Again, for next time, I'm Mark Anacito for Music, Facts, and Figures, a podcast by Mark Anacito. Thank you, and God bless. Good night.